Sup, fools? Are you a QTR patron? If you are, I would like to say thank you very much. Patrons are what keep this podcast going. They are people who donate a recurring monthly sum to help support the QTR podcast. You can find the link right in my podcast description. Before we get started, I want to thank people like my friends over at Quantumize.com. Quantumize is an AI-powered research platform, quantitative research platform that gives you access to over 10,000 stocks, options, cryptos. I saw the other day they were doing these really cool option strategies over there, it looked like. Definitely worth a free trial. There's a link in my profile, and they were recently named by Benzinga as the best alternative to a Bloomberg terminal. So if you want, check out my friends that support me, Quantumize.com. I also want to shout out my friend Jake over at the Behind the Bid podcast, also supporting me. You can check out the podcast every morning, the Behind the Bid podcast, where Jake reviews 8 to 10 ticker symbols. He spends about a minute on them each. It is a great way to start your morning and get a little insight as to what's going to be going on for your trading day moving forward. That is behindthebid.com if you want to check out his podcast. I'd also like to thank my friends over at Corvus Gold for checking in, my brother Nathan Michaud over at Investors Underground, which is a great online day trading community, education and chat rooms over there. My buddy Chris Bede is in the house. Ken R., Chris Boas, Russ Valenti, Piggly Wiggly is in the house. Nathan Weiss, Andre Gagnon, Mike, Matt Merle, and Chris Sharkey all coming through for me. And some of my recent patrons, people like Fire Bruce Allen just checked in. My friend M.A. and M. Research is in the house. Walter Berkowitz, P-Dog checked in. Toy Pam is in the house, or I think it's pronounced Fam. It's spelled Fam, but I think it's pronounced Pam. If I got it wrong, whatever. But my brother, good to see you. My friend David Spots, Dale Short, Sam Masters, all just checked in over the last couple of days. David Fisher, Chris Sutton checked in. Sabin Investment Management checked in. My brother Matt checked in on the 21st of March. I appreciate you, Matt. Coin a Day, Andre Garvalov, KSav, Vimal, Sivaraju. Appreciate the shit out of you guys. Real quick before we get started with our interview today, two other things you got to know. One is I am not an investment advisor. I don't hold any licenses, and this is not investment advice. Do your research elsewhere, fools. I also recommend, but don't technically require, but it's a very strong recommendation, a two-drink minimum for this podcast. Folks, it just helps. You know how on those toothbrush commercials, they're like 9 out of 10 dentists recommend Colgate. Well, 9 out of 10 listeners of this podcast recommend also guzzling two drinks before you even start the podcast. It will help out. And yes, I know what your next question is. Chris, is it okay to have a drink while the podcast is going on? The answer to that is a resounding fuck yes, folks. All right? So 9 out of 10 listeners, there's going to be that one exception. I can't do it. I don't have a liver, etc., etc., etc. Excuses, whatever. But for the most part, join me. Let's have a cocktail. And let's talk about the fucked up world of finance and the markets. Because it is a fucked up shit show of epic proportions. And on that positive note, on the line with me, I have the legendary New York Stock Exchange floor trader, Mr. Kenneth Polcari. How are you, sir?
I'm good, sir. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic, man. It's great to talk to you. It's been way too long.
Yeah, well, you know, time goes by before you know it, and then and life changes, right? Because as you know, I actually left this end of the business in December, and I launched a new business with Ron Insonner and Nancy Tangler, and we launched a high net worth and ultra high net worth and institutional asset management business, which we got off the ground in January. And so it's been a very interesting time, right? So I'm still involved very much in the industry. I just got out of the transactional end of it. For a number of reasons, because it's you know, at 58 years old, it's time for me to figure out who I want to be when I grow up.
Mm-hmm.
and so that's it. So I'm still very much within the industry. I'll be making my way down to Palm Beach in about 2 months and setting up office. So
that sounds awful.
yeah, it sounds awful. It's all good.
You still in New York
anyway,
now?
Are you
still on the desk now or what?
Well, I'm on the not down here. I'm not on the desk because I'm off the. I'm up in my office in Westchester County, New York.
Ah, okay.
Temporarily until I close on my house and then move down to Palm Beach, and then it'll be an office in Palm Beach, wherever that is. I haven't opened it yet, but that's where I'll be, and then I'll be able to do my my television commentary, everything from one of the offices down in Palm Beach.
Oh, awesome. But you're at the exchange today, right? I called you here at the exchange, right?
I'm at the exchange today because I had to be downtown to meet a couple of people, so I came in here to do this podcast with you.
Oh, awesome, man. Thank you so much. Well, yeah, I know that you've been really busy. I've been watching your emails and watching kind of you change professions, and I think on behalf of everybody, I want to say good luck with the future endeavors, man. I think it's awesome. I know I sent you an email after the news came out, but will we be seeing you back on TV then?
Yes, you will. I'll still I still have my role as a CNBC commentator on CNBC, and I'll just do it. Sometimes I'll be doing it, if I'm here in New York, I'll be doing it from the floor of the exchange or over in Englewood Cliffs, and other times I'll be doing it down from the studio in Palm Beach.
Okay, awesome. You know, I just had a chat with, speaking of CNBC, I just had a chat with Guy Adami a couple weeks ago. I'm not sure if you got a chance to listen to that podcast, but
I did not get a chance to listen to it yet.
Are you friendly with him? Have you met him?
Yeah.
Yeah, he seems like a great guy.
He's a good guy. Yeah, Guy's a good guy.
So one of the things that we talked about on that podcast together that I'd like to open by getting your idea of is I was asking him why these news networks don't have a lot of bears on. And he said to me that, guys like Peter Schiff, who we were talking about specifically, he said he thought they were bad for TV. And I wanted to get your take on that. What do you think?
Well, you know what I think is interesting? I'm not necessarily sure it's bad for TV. I think if you constantly have bears on, you constantly have, kind of the negative side of the story, it's bad for the story, right? And so it's fine to be balanced. I think you should absolutely be balanced, but you shouldn't be too far to the left or too far to the right in terms of bears versus bulls, right?
Sure.
You want to have, when the news gets negative. See, here's always what happens. The minute, like now, last Friday, when the 3-month and 10-bill yield inverted,
right,
that was perceived as negative, and so everyone jumps on the bandwagon. It's negative, 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 and then everybody that's on it's negative, 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 and so it tends to, in my mind, it tends to almost feed on itself, right? That whole negative sentiment, which then causes, algorithms to start reacting negatively, right? Because they scan the headlines, they pick out the words. The words are always negative. The algorithms create sell orders. The market goes lower. The buyers pull away, and so it feeds on itself. Now, listen, it feeds on itself the other way as well. When all the news is positive and they get everyone positive, 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 then we see that same thing happen, and which is why you see such volatility in the market. Which is why I think if it's balanced, you have you got a negative view, but you also have a positive view, and so therefore, I think that's probably the better way to play it. But listen, it sells airtime, I guess. It sells newspapers, when it's either all negative or all positive.
Why don't you think anybody on the financial networks talks about algorithmic buying and selling when the market is going up 400, 500, 600 points in a day versus going down?
Because I don't think that a lot of people in the media consider that a sexy story. They don't consider it but the fact is, it is the truth, sexy or not. The fact is, the market is very much driven by robotics and algorithms and artificial intelligence, right? These smart logic algos that just do nothing but scrape and scan headlines all over the place, whether they're in print, whether on social media, whether they're on the television, and they scan and then they react to words. And I think after a while that the media doesn't think that, it is what it is. That's the market structure we have. Everyone understands it. So there's nothing new in that story. Although, if you look at what happened between October and December, and especially that crack in December that we had, all driven by automation, right? Now, certainly the data might have been weakening, and the interest rate hike in October may have been, or in September may have been part of that whole story. I get it. But when the news becomes negative, again, it feeds on itself, and then the automation, the robotics start feeding sell orders in, and at the same time, on the buy side, it draws the bids, right? It makes the bid lower, and there's a void in liquidity, which is why you see the markets thrash around and collapse as quickly as it did. And when we see that happen, whether it's on the upside or downside, it either collapses quickly or it rallies really quickly, and then it finally stabilizes once it kind of gets to a level after it's all calmed down. But the damage and the devastation, especially on the downside, that can happen before you even know it. And I think that's the story that really needs to be told, because the average investor, Joe Q Public, they see this. They see the volatility. They see the market down 300, 400, 500 points, and they scratch their head going, how does this happen? And I think that's the story that needs to be told. And that's why, whether it's sexy or not, people should understand the role that artificial intelligence and algorithms and play in the market structure that we have and why we see such at times violent swings.
But why isn't it a sexy story on the way up? How come nobody on television is saying something like, hey, the Dow was up 700 today and we had this immense rally on whatever, tax cut news or positive trade talk, something that we've rallied on 100 times before. And hey, before everybody gets euphoric, let us just remind you that, you know, a lot of this could be algorithmic panic buying that just happens as a result of this. How come nobody takes the time to disclaim a rally like that,
listen,
but immediately it's talked about when there's a move to the downside?
Well, because I think on the way down it hurts, right? It cuts harder on the way down.
Sure.
As the market's under pressure and people are losing money, it hurts more, it cuts more. On the way up, everyone's patting themselves on the back going, look at me, I made $1,000 today, or I made $5,000 today, or I made $100,000 today, whatever it was. It's a different mood, it's a different mentality, right? Although, I will tell you, every time I got the opportunity on days like that, whether the market was up or down, every time I got on TV, I would say a lot of this is driven by the algorithms. You have to understand that. Right, the moves are sometimes way overdone, and it's completely driven by the technology, because the technology, it's great, it can read words and it understands what the definition of word is, but it doesn't understand the intonation or the intention of the word. Right, when you and I talk, when you hear my voice, you hear in my voice, you hear either anxiety or you hear happiness or you hear, you know, peacefulness and patience. In a written word, you can't hear any of that.
Right.
And so when you write an email, in your head, you're writing it one way, and the person reading it could interpret it a completely different way depending on the kind of day they're having. If I read the email and I'm having a tough day and I read your email and for some reason I'm not reading it in the tone you wrote it, I'm reading in a different tone. I call you up and I say, Chris, what was that about? You go, what are you talking about?
Right.
But when you're talking to somebody, you hear my voice, and so you don't have that. That's not a question any longer.
People in relationships probably know that, right? From texting and texting each other, right?
Right. And listen, I think texting and emails can be the two worst kinds of communication out there, for all my opinion. And when I was here on the floor a lot of times, because the industry's changed so much, people, when they send you an order, they send you a text message, they send you an instant message on Bloomberg, or an instant message over, right? No, and I'd say my partner and I would say, pick up the goddamn phone and talk to somebody, because there's so much lost in translation. And so I was always wondering, you know, maybe it's because I'm 58 years old and I did it the old-fashioned way for so long. I have no idea, but one way or the other, that was the way I learned how to do it. That's how I do it. That's why I do it. And I think that's what makes you successful. I think a lot of times in the written word, it gets confusing and it gets and it leaves itself open.
And there's no way for you to come back with follow-up questions.
That's exactly right.
I know this from personal experience from working orders, you know, which I've done before and do once in a while, when somebody just says buy 3,000. Well, you don't know if it's at market. You don't know if it's at limit. You don't know what what they want you to take it up to. You don't know if they want to know, you know, what the liquidity looks like before they buy it. So you can at least, when you're speaking to them, you can say, all right, I got an offer for 3,000 right here. Like, you want to just take that, or do you want to take it up to a certain price, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And so I think that's what you have to be concerned about, right? Especially on days like that. And listen, I suppose that people, they're just used to it now, so it's just what they understand. That's just how the market works. But yet, that's also why you have such, you know, it's part of the reason why I think some days you have such volatility.
Now, are you the kind of guy, like, when it comes to family stuff, that you'll be more inclined to pick up the phone than you will be to send a text message? Has it, like, conditioned you another?
Well, you know, if it's between me and my wife and my kids and it's a thread and we're texting and the theme, we know what the theme is, yeah, it's relatively okay. But if I get something important to say, I am not necessarily putting that in the text. I'm calling them up.
Right.
You know, we've got a family conference call number.
And do you really?
Everyone dial in. And so they all dial in. Well, they all. It's my wife and two kids, right? I mean, actually, my kids aren't even kids anymore. They're adults, right? I don't have kids anymore. I have adults for children.
Hey, but in some respects, you know, you run the family like you run a business, right?
Right. Yeah, right.
Especially, you know, as an old Italian New Yorker, right?
as an old Italian, well, really a Bostonian, but yeah, I've been in New York for 38 years, so so you could say I'm a New Yorker.
So let me ask you, Kenny. Look, the feel to me in the market right now is as follows, and I want to get your reaction to this, right? I certainly feel like, and one of the reasons I love talking to you, man, is because, you know, I do see you on CNBC, but, like, I also know you're very genuine, and you don't mince words, and you say exactly how you feel, and to your credit, you are one of the people that pointed out on the way up about algorithms. You do talk about it on television. You've talked about it with me before. So I want to get your take on what's going on right now with the Fed. Do you think that they're doing more harm than good? And Powell, really, in my opinion here, capitulating. Okay, we're back at all-time highs. Are we in the middle of a correction in a bear market, or are we looking at a bull market that just had a bearish correction? And what do you think? What do you think about the Fed?
So here's what I think. First of all, I think it's an incredibly difficult job to have, right? Especially since we've been in 12 years of financial crisis, because as much as people say, oh, you know, the crisis was in 2009, 10, and 11, I'm not so sure, because look at this. We're 12 years out, and we're still having trouble getting inflation above 2%. It's not even there yet. We're still having trouble there, right? Interest rates are still at historical lows 12 years into this. And so in my opinion, we're still very much in this cycle of crisis. Now, it's not nearly the crisis it was, but when you talk about the Fed, look, at some point, and I was always a proponent of, they got to start raising rates, they got to start normalizing, they got to start putting rates back to, you know, some level of normalcy, whether it's in this country or around the world. Any central bank, whether it's ECB, the Bank of Japan, the People's Bank of China, whatever it is. And so I was on the side that I did think that Powell did the right thing in September when he raised rates, right? He started that process. He was very transparent about it. The market knew it. The market knew it was coming. But when December came, and there was this, or October, right, after the September rate hike and then the October conversation when the market started to come undone, part of me thought, you know, here we are, here are these traders and everyone throwing a hissy fit and everyone's just going to grow up and act like men and you know, swallow it, right? Just, it's got to happen at some point. It's going to be painful at some point, but the longer you put it off, the more pain it's going to be. But then when the market really came unglued in December, I thought to myself, well, you know, maybe it was wrong. Maybe we shouldn't have raised rates in September. Maybe they should have been a little bit more patient. And so then you run into the argument because, you know, you had Trump out there screaming at him. You had all these people screaming at him. So then you want to know, is he capitulating, or is he and the Federal Reserve Board taking another look at the data and really assessing what it is? And, you know, you can argue both ways.
What's so bad about a 15% correction in the markets?
There isn't any. Quite honestly, there's nothing bad about a 15% correction in the market. And the fact is, if we had a 15%, we had a 20% correction, right, in December.
Right.
I mean, at one point, for whether it was a day or 2 days, you know, the market did correct down to 20%. But then it rallied right back. Actually, what I think needs to happen, the market needs to correct it. It needs to kind of churn around there for a little bit in order to kind of shake the trees and shake the branches.
Sure, but
and that's what it didn't do, right? It didn't do that. And so my fear is it's going to happen again. And it's going to continue happening until you start to get the activity that allows it to create a real foundation at that level, right? In a 15% correction or a 20% correction, that it's going to stay there. So my
question to you is, when that happens, Kenny, why is your attitude, well, hey, maybe the Fed's doing the wrong thing, instead of something like you're talking about now, which is, hey, this may actually create an opportunistic, you know, spot for me and my clients, or maybe this needs to happen. Why then? Because you just said, you know, you kind of pivoted on what you thought after that happened.
Well, because here's the problem, and it gets a little bit antsy, right? Because the speed at which it happens, again, here we go talking about the automation and the robotics and the algorithms and all that stuff. The speed at which it happens is I think what's so unnerving, right? When I came into this business, and I'm not wishing to go back to 30 years ago, but the markets didn't move as quickly, and people had time to think and digest and react.
Right.
Today, they don't, because everything happens in a picosecond, and before you know it, the market's down 700 points, and everyone's scratching their head going, oh, my God, oh, my God. And so my sense is that the Fed's going to have to the Fed has to modernize as well, right? The markets are modernized. The Fed has to modernize. And so maybe the thinking, maybe two and three quarters is the new normal now. maybe 4% or 4.5%, which was the normal for my whole lifetime, is no longer the normal. The world has changed, right? Technology's changed the world. And so maybe the Fed's being too aggressive. Maybe 2.75 is the new normal. And so it's going to need time to – the market is going to need time to assess that.
If that's the new normal, though, Kenny, then what happens the next time the Fed needs to act? What's left in their toolbox?
I guess we go like Europe, right? Germany just went negative on rates last week, right? So like, what happens? We go to zero, and if zero's not enough, it goes negative. I mean, look, although we haven't gone there, Europe is in negative rates. Japan was in negative rates. Well, I think Japan might still be in negative rates. If they're not, they're right at zero. But I don't really know what happens after that, right? If negative rates don't even work, then what happens? And I guess that's something we're going to have to see. Look, this has been unprecedented, right? This whole great financial crisis that started in 2007, and then everything that's happened since, whether it was, 10 different programs of quantitative easing, not only here but around the world, unprecedented moves by central banks. And so it took us 10 years to get in. If anyone thinks we're going to be out in 2 or 3 years, it's wrong. I wouldn't be surprised if it takes us another, 7 years or 8 years to get out of it for real normalcy to return to the market.
What do you mean by get out of it? What do you mean by get out of it?
Well, get out of it where I still think, because I don't think that 2.5% is normal in terms of the new normal.
Of course it isn't.
I still do think that 4% money or 4.5% money is the normal. I think that will always really kind of be the normal. So if it takes us 8 more years to get there, that's what it's going to take. Look, it took us 10 years. We went to zero almost immediately in terms of rates when the crisis happened, but then we held them there for a good 10 years, for a good eight and a half or 9 years. And so to get out and to get the market to recognize, quote-unquote, normalcy again, might take just as long.
Yeah, but don't you think over the next 7 years or so, let's say it takes 7 years for us to get back to 4%, and let's just assume 4% is the normal, which I don't know if I agree with, but let's just say that plays out. I mean, over the course of those 7 years, 7 years from now, we know the economy is slowing, right? So what is going to allow central bankers to raise rates and normalize them to 4% between now and then, when the underlying entity, right, the economy, and I know nobody looks at the economy anymore, people just look at the stock market, but if the economy is turning to a halt, what's going to allow them to do that and move it to 4% without creating an even bigger problem?
Right, but I guess the question is the economy really grinding to a halt? I'm not necessarily sure that I agree that the U.S. economy is grinding to a halt. I'm not sure I believe that. Now, look, I think the economy has changed in terms of its makeup, in terms of where people can make money and where they can't, because technology has kind of disrupted the whole economy. And I think that's, you have to also kind of consider the disruption that technology has in terms of where the market's going to be, where the economy is, and what really will be defined as normal as technology continues to disrupt. But the fact is, I do think if we grow at 2.5% and 3%, or 3% and 3.25% consistently now, then we'll get ourselves back to normal.
But don't you think?
And so we'll see. Today we were at 2.0. The fourth quarter was what, 2.2%?
Yes. Yeah. Revised
quarter,
lower.
The whole year was. I think for the year we were just at 3%. Right.
Yes. Yes.
Annualized, the year was at 3%. I think the quarter was 2.2, but the year was at 3.
Yep, that's right.
Right.
So my question, though, is going to be, don't you think the consumer right now is tapped out in terms of the amount of debt that's outstanding right now?
Well, I certainly think there is a lot of debt, but if you look at the consumer confidence numbers, they're still at historical highs at 124, right? But break even is at 100, so below 100, that's really a negative number. Anything above 100 is considered, positive consumer sentiment. And even though it ticked down a little bit this month or last month, whenever the report came out, it's still at 124, which is still fairly positive. Now, that being said, the consumer straddled with debt. There are some consumers definitely are, and there are some who are not, and the ones who are not will continue to kind of push it along, right? The ones who are they're gonna end up going out the way they go out, whether it's through bankruptcy or whether it's however they do it. But I think that that's going to be another rude awakening for a lot of the revolving debt, right? For revolving debt companies, whether it's Macy's or Bloomberg's or Joe or Nordstrom's, whatever.
Right.
I mean, the rates that they charge at 23 or 25% interest rates is usurious. And how they even do that is beyond me in the first place, but they do. And when people start really falling off the rolls because they just can't do it, you know, that is something that I think will change. But one way or the other, I think that the U.S. economy continues to go along. I don't see it necessarily slowing so much at kind of the way the media might have you believe. I actually think it's fairly still. I think it's still fairly robust.
So, what does the situation look like to you? Let's say theoretically, between now and when we normalize, rates have to go negative, right? Let's say that we start to cut now, which is really what it feels like is going to happen, regardless
well,
of what
Fed funds rate are pricing in a cut before Christmas, right? So,
right.
The next six or eight months, Fed funds are now pricing in a cut versus neutral. Never mind even a rise, but
right.
Even neutral, right? And I'm not sure if that just happened because, you know, that just happened recently, and it happened, I think, after Friday when the 3 month and the 10 year inverted.
Correct.
Now, remember,
yep.
The twos and tens have not inverted, and quite honestly, the twos and tens are the one that most people pay attention to. And I understand the relationship of the 3 month and the 10 year, because the 3 month is essentially equal to the Fed funds rate. So right now, the 10 year is lower than the Fed funds rate, which is 2.4%. And I think the 10 year yesterday was at 2.39. But the twos and tens have not inverted. And I think there's another mixed message about what the state of the economy is. And I think if you look at the other stuff that's been happening, the data has been very mixed, right? New home sales are way down, but existing home sales blew the roof off the house, right? Service PMIs and manufacturing PMIs are still in the mid-50s, which are very bullish, right? Above 50 is expansionary, below 50 is contractionary. We're not even near 50 yet, so those continue to be robust and bullish. And so, you know, there's certainly a mixed bag.
Yeah, at the same time, you see prices coming down also, though, too. Like in New York, for example, you know, real estate prices have been on the decline, right?
Well, okay, but real estate prices in New York have come down because the Tax Reform Act, you know, killed all the deductions.
And that is a part of it. Yep.
I just sold my house, right?
Yep.
So it took me a year to sell my house, right? But the Tax Reform Act annihilated real estate in Westchester County, New York
right.
City. You know, Connecticut's getting hit hard. New Jersey's getting hit hard. Massachusetts getting hit hard. California's certainly getting hit hard because you lost all those deductions. Those are big Democratic kind of social program states, and that's fine. You lived here. You understood that. You paid your taxes. You helped to provide for those social programs. But then they took away all that benefit, and they still want you to provide the social programs. And now that you got all these people moving out of New York, now they're stuck because now they're losing tax revenue, so now they raise taxes on the people that are left. And at some point, it's not going to work anymore. It's just not going to work.
So turning back to New York, I wanted to get your opinion because it's been a really long time since we've talked. So I wanted to get your opinion on the Amazon mess. It was something I had actually planned on asking you about a month ago when it happened, but we haven't spoken since then. What do you think about them driving Amazon out of New York City?
I think it's a debacle. I think they should be ashamed of themselves.
I agree.
The deal that Amazon was offered, and listen, you can argue that why should you give a big company like that, you know, incentives to come here? Okay, well, think about it for a minute. You look at the much bigger picture. Look what they were going to create. Look what the income and the tax revenues that they were going to create. And you know, AOC and the others are bitching about the $3 billion that she thinks is sitting in a bank account somewhere that she gets to spend. That's not it at all.
Right.
The $3 billion was coming out of all the money that they were going to create for us.
Right.
And quite honestly, they were going to turn a part of the city into this new, vibrant, life-giving area of, you know, Long Island City, which is just across from Roosevelt Island. It's great. It was a perfect location, but what it would have done for the city, what it would have done for mass transit, because they were gonna throw money at the transit system, they were gonna throw money at the schools, they were gonna throw money, right? And for her and the other four or five politicians that all of a sudden, you know, thought it was a bad deal. I think it's a travesty. I think it's an absolute travesty. And I don't think the New Yorkers who all of a sudden jumped on that bandwagon realize what they gave up or what we lost as a result.
And for her to come out after that happened and basically make the statement to the media that's $3 billion we could have put into the subway system. All it
right,
does is
exactly
show that
right.
she didn't have any...
She clearly didn't understand.
She had no clue, okay?
And because she thinks that $3 billion was sitting in some bank account, and
right.
now she gets to spend it. She had no idea. And I think what's even more amazing, you know, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat doesn't make a difference, but what's more amazing to me when she came out with those kinds of comments and clearly a lack of understanding, that nobody on that side of the fence said to her, whoa, 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 slow down, sit down, you don't understand. But they didn't, and they let her continue to just talk and talk and talk as if what she was saying was correct. Meanwhile, it was so incorrect, but it's beyond me that nobody in that party decided to correct her.
Who's going to step in, okay? Let's not talk partisan politics, but like, who's going to step in and explain it to her? Because, Kenny, all you have to do is watch one congressional hearing where they're trying to address anything having to do with finance or the capital markets, and it's fucking clear as day that nobody in Congress understands
right.
economics.
Right.
Nobody in Congress understands how the market works, right? So
right.
who, and especially on the Democratic end, right? Who's gonna step in and explain that to her?
Well, you know, that is such a great question. I would think, and you know, it was very interesting. Chuck Schumer was silent during that whole debacle. Chuck Schumer, who's the senior state senator who lives in Brooklyn, who basically lives in New York City, was silent when all that was going on. And I thought to myself, where is Chuck Schumer in this whole thing? Why isn't he opening his mouth? Why isn't he correcting the conversation? Now, listen, say what you want. Either you know, you're not into big business, you don't want Amazon here, it's disruptive, it's this, it's that, blah, blah, blah. You can argue that if you want, but the fact is the benefits that would have brought to the city, to the subway system, to the people who live in the city because of the upgraded subways, because of the money being thrown at the schools, I think they made a huge, huge mistake.
Yeah, I guess the only other argument that, you know, you might not have an answer for would be this gentrification argument where people that live in, you know, in that area of Queens,
yep.
they say, hey, we don't want it in our backyard, which...
Right.
And I guess
to some degree,
you can't tell people what they want and what they don't want, right?
No, but that's true. But I'm not sure that they really understood what they didn't want in their backyard, because
right.
their backyard was going to be wildly improved. There was going to be, like I said, new infrastructure, new roads. There were going to be new businesses, new restaurants, new stores. There were going to be all this life-giving moves that were going to come to that part of Long Island City. And maybe look, I don't live in Long Island City, so I don't know what it's like.
Right.
But maybe nobody wants it to change. Maybe nobody does want the gentrification. Maybe they just want it the way it is. I think clearly that's the message that was sent, was, you know, we don't want that. And I think they were short-sighted. I don't think they really understood what they gave up.
Well, and it felt like they took the position first without evaluating
right,
it.
Without understanding.
Right.
Yeah.
And then fought to defend
it. It's still beyond me that she went around for days and days and days ranting and raving about the $3 billion that she was going to spend on hiring new teachers and building out subways. And I'm sitting there scratching my head going, she doesn't understand. And why nobody decided to pull her aside and explain it to her is beyond me. Her and, by the way, not just her, but her and the half a dozen other politicians that all of a sudden stood up and go, we don't want it. Because look what happened. After Amazon said we're out, and after Amazon said they left, there was this massive mea culpa, right?
Yeah.
All of a sudden,
yep.
Cuomo's on his knees, and de Blasio's on his knees, and everybody wants it, and they're begging them to come back. I wouldn't have come back if I was Amazon. Why would you want to jump into that fire? Why?
No. Well, it's like, you know, it's like getting dumped and then coming back
right.
to the relationship. First off, it's never
absolutely
the same,
not.
Right? The relationship loses its essence, number one.
No, but listen, let's not be foolish. Amazon is already in New York City, not to the extent that they were going to be, but there is an Amazon center. I'm not sure it's a delivery center, but I think it's more workers, more tech guys and all that stuff. Because, you know, because parts of New York are becoming very high tech, right, to challenge Silicon Valley. And so in that sense, you know, there's Google here, there's Microsoft, there's Amazon. And so Amazon does have a presence in the city, but not the kind of presence that was going to be created with that whole second headquarters space.
You know, I think it plays into this idea that, you know, capitalism is bad, and if capitalism is bad, then the corporations are the enemy. And so
And that's exactly her mantra.
Right.
That's exactly the mantra of the far left. And I think that's actually dangerous.
I think it's very dangerous,
people,
too.
People will compare it to the far right when we had the, two elections ago when they had the Tea Party, which I also agree was way too far to the right. Right? Whatever, I think you have to find a way to come to the middle, and you have to be moderate on both sides. Whether you're a Democrat or Republican, you can have your beliefs, but when you go either way too far to the right, like the Tea Party did, or way too far to the left, like this current class of young Democrats are, I think it's a problem. I think it's a real problem.
I mean, how dangerous do you think it is that nobody – so I've watched a number of these congressional hearings over the last 5-6 years – where, the Valiant executives, or they're talking about even going back to Goldman Sachs and the financial crisis and all these other little, how dangerous do you think it is that politicians on neither side of the aisle really seem to understand, the basics of economics?
Well, it certainly is an issue, I think, but I don't think that's a new issue. I think that's been the way it is, because politicians are expected to, to lead and to manage, and they're supposed to have information on everything, whether it's the law, whether it's economics, whether it's business, whether it's social programs, whatever it is. And so it's really impossible to be an expert in everything, which is why then they're supposed to surround themselves with people that have specialties, whether it's business, social programs.
But let's say somebody that sits on the Financial Services Committee, Kenny.
It's scary. It's scary to me that when you watch the Financial Services Committee, some of the questions that come out of the congressmen and women, right? And those questions are either they're their own questions or they're fed to them by their staff. But the fact that they ask some of the questions they ask should really concern everybody. Whatever side of the aisle on, it should concern everybody.
Yeah, and you can look down and see who is addressing their notes when they're directing a line of questioning. Also, the only person that never looked down a lot to look at their notes that I can remember of late was Ron Paul, when he would, a couple of those times that he got Bernanke, and, oftentimes when he was speaking finance, he's not a guy that had to look at his notes. I mean, he had a fundamental understanding of economics, right, Regardless of whether or not you agree with him theoretically, right? And now I was just watching a hearing the other day, maybe it was 2 days ago or 3 days ago, I'm not sure, but I think it was AOC questioning somebody from Wells Fargo. One of the things that she asked as she was looking down at her notes over and over and over again to look at, like you said, what her staffers had provided for her, one of the questions she asked was about Wells Fargo lending to an oil company.
Yeah, and, I know. Did you see that?
Did you see it?
It was amazing to me that she asked that question. Amazing to me that not only would she ask that question, but that honestly, that her questions weren't vetted by other people on the committee before she asked them, because that was a question that absolutely not only blew my mind, but I think anybody who was paying attention, who listened to it, sat there and looked at her and said, "What are you even suggesting?"
Yeah. So tell the listeners if they weren't watching it.
And so she asked him a question. The CEO of what was it? Wells Fargo. Is that who it was?
Yeah.
Who, by the way, apparently just resigned. I just saw that on CNBC.
You did, yeah. The stock's up 3% on the news.
But she asked him a question about finance, like a finance issue, right? About financing businesses, and the question had to do with
the Dakota Access Pipeline.
Say it again.
It had to do with the Dakota Access Pipeline, and they were part of a consortium of investors.
Yeah, but it was something about people were dying. She asked a question that they were supporting, right? Wasn't it that offensive, by the way, her question? I actually have to Google the question again, but I'll never forget sitting there just listening to her asking this question as if the bank were responsible because they financed some deal, that the bank was not responsible, whether it was climate or whether it was, destroying the environment, whatever it was. But because the bank was part of the financing, of which there were, five or six banks that were all part of the financing,
right,
she asked him specifically his role in destroying the climate. Say it was a climate change question, whatever
right,
it was. And he looked at her and he goes, "What are you talking about? We just provided the financing. We didn't opine on what she was suggesting, right?" And that's what he said to her. And then she just stopped. After he kind of laid it out and put it in her place, she just goes, "Okay, I'll move on." Because I think it became clear to her that she was going way down the wrong path.
Yeah, she was asking about the impact of a new pipeline. and she was trying
on the climate,
to hold
on the environment or something, right?
Right, and she was trying to hold the CEO of the bank responsible, who was part of a consortium, I think, of 10, you know, companies that wound up financing this pipeline or are going to be. And she asked him, you know, like, well, you know, what do you think about doing that? And he was like, well, we're not operating the pipeline, you know. And I think she said, like, well, what if the pipeline bursts or something like that, too? And he's like, well, you know, we don't have anything to do with that. We're just supplying the funds.
Right. Correct.
You know,
but she made it as if because they supplied the funds and they were able to destroy the economy, destroy the environment. So therefore, he is responsible.
Right.
I mean, it was tough to connect the dots.
Right.
And I think when he answered her, she realized that it was tough to connect the dots. And so then she said, okay, I'm moving on. And she completely changed the subject.
So let me ask you a question, Kenny. Going into the second half of this year, because I assume it'll probably be a month or two maybe before we talk again. But going into the summer here, what does sentiment feel like when you're down there on the floor right now? I mean, look, you're in tune with things a little bit more than probably the guy sitting at home. What does it feel like in the industry compared to kind of the feelings you've gotten over the last three decades since you've been down there, almost four?
You know, the industry continues to change, right? It's very innovative. Certainly, it's becoming much – technology continues to disrupt it, not only necessarily down here on the floor, but in the industry, right? I mean, there's certainly a lot of disruption. But the fact is, I also get the sense that it's starting to bottom out a little bit. And the technology is the technology, but a lot of the job losses that were a result of kind of this advancing technology have slowed, and now that they are much more, there's much more of a push to not get rid of the human beings so much, especially in the financial services industry, because of such volatility and the fact that the argument about having humans kind of, you know, maintaining some level of presence is actually good for the markets and good for the capital markets, the exchanges. And so therefore it seems to me it seems to be subsiding. That being said, I think the market does feel a little bit weaker as we move into April, which is kind of seasonal as the market sells off going into tax day, but then, you know, seems to rally again going into late spring, early summer. And I think, you know, you're going to see that. The only thing that could disrupt it this year is if in the next 2 weeks they come out with, you know, with the final China deal, I think then you see the market take off. But barring that, I think you'll see some weakness going into the next 2 weeks. And then you'll see the market bottom out and then move higher into the summer.
I mean, how much of that trade agreement do you think is priced in already? I mean, I feel like it was when tax cuts happened. It was used every time the market went up. As reasoning
and it is
as
used.
To...
It is used, absolutely. It is used. I think there's a fair amount of it priced in, but I think what's not priced in, like you saw today, and the headline today, I think was indicative. You know, the fact that the Chinese now have they're putting forced technology transfer conversations on the table, which is something they never did, and that was one of the things holding the market back, and I think that was one of the things that kind of kept the market on edge. But I think if they really want to discuss and I think that's one of the bigger issues is the forced technology transfer, right, that they impose upon us when we go to do business in China. I think that is a game changer in the sense that it will change your conversation, and I don't think that's priced into the market yet. I think if we hear more about that, then the market will take it. And I think, you know, you saw today the market closed up 10 points on the S&P, which wasn't so tremendous, up 0.5%, but I think it'll be part of the story as over the next couple of weeks as it goes along. But I don't think it's completely priced in yet.
So, Kenny, how much longer you have? Is today going to be technically like your last day downtown before you wind up flying south?
No, not at all. I come into the city probably a couple times a week because I've got meetings in the city and I got stuff to do in the city until I ultimately move out of New York, and then I'll be in the city probably once a month.
All right. Well, you have anything else on the market that you want to cover over the next couple minutes before we...
No, I think it's good. I think it's good. Actually, I have to get ready to go for a meeting in five more minutes anyway, so I think this is good.
I know you were at a busy schedule today, so I appreciate you coming on. And let's do it again maybe in a couple months when we have some time once you're settled in and moved down south.
Great. No problem. And I'll do it from... I'll be doing it from Palm Beach.
Beautiful. Maybe I'll come down there. We'll do it live from a bar somewhere.
Goodbye.
All right. Thanks so much, Kenny. Bye-bye. That was Kenny Polcari checking in from the desk at the New York Stock Exchange. Would really like to have had some more time with him. Next interview, I'll make sure that I do. And if you haven't listened to my previous podcast with Kenny, go back and check him out. He tells some great stories about, you know, specifically about living in New York through 9/11, which I thought was a fascinating story. Don't necessarily agree with him on everything having to do with macro, but I do always welcome him on here, not only because he's a very nice guy and a class act, but because as somebody that's been on the floor for the last four decades, it's really, I find his take very insightful and I find it relevant because he does have a feel for those types of things that maybe the retail trader at home doesn't have a feel for. So great to have Kenny on and awesome to pick his brain on the Amazon stuff. As a New Yorker, I will be back very soon, folks. But for now, I am out.
Peace.